May it please the court. My name is Dana Weiss, registration number 36656, and I represent Mr. Clark. I'd like to focus today's argument on the first two issues contained in the opening brief. Regarding the first, Mr. Clark was deprived of his due process right to present a complete defense when the trial court ruled he could not present a crucial witness's statements at his trial. The witness's statements directly challenged the testimony of the only witness who said that Mr. Clark essentially admitted that he committed the crime charge. Mr. Clark was convicted of second-degree assault in this case based on testimony by George Lycone, who testified that Mr. Clark had told him that he had fought with and he had killed his roommate. George Lycone said that his brother, Timothy, was there when Mr. Clark made this statement and indeed could corroborate that he said it. However, when questioned about this by detectives, Timothy Lycone told police in a videotaped interview that he never heard Clark make any such statements and that he never observed any injuries or indications that Mr. Clark had been in a fight.
But didn't Timothy also say that he wasn't close enough to have heard what was said, if anything?
No, he didn't. He actually said, if you review that transcript, what he actually said, was that he said, first of all, he started talking to the detective and he said that on the date in question, he and his brother brought him food and they said their highs and buys. And that's at about 6 minutes, 50 seconds into the interview. He said that he didn't look like, Mr. Clark did not look like he had any injuries to his hand. He repeatedly said this, or anything he said, any injuries. That was at about 7 minutes, 5 seconds into the interview. He said that Mr. Clark never said anything about a fight. And he's saying these statements, or making these statements to the detective affirmatively the entire time. And that's at about 7 minutes, 20 seconds into the interview. He said that George never said that Mr. Clark had ever said anything about a fight as they then left the meeting with Mr. Clark. He said that Mr. Clark didn't look like he was scraped up, his hands, or anything. And that's at 8 minutes, 50 seconds in. Then there was a break where the detective then left the room. And when the detective comes back in, that's when, again, Timothy Lycone then again reaffirms, he didn't say anything. And that's when the detective starts asking him, you're leaving something out, accusing him of leaving something out, not being forthcoming. And he says, no, he didn't say anything. And the detective asks, he didn't say anything? He says, I didn't even know that he had a roommate. And the detective says, the problem that I have is that you're saying some things that match up, but some things that don't. Maybe you didn't hear. And the detective starts suggesting at that point. He's firm in his testimony or in his statements, though, the whole time leading up to that, that he was there, he didn't see anything, he didn't see any injuries, and Mr. Clark did not make any statements. He said that they said highs and buys, and then they went off. He also said that they were giggling when they were having whatever short conversation that they had, and that then they left. And it wasn't until later when the detective starts suggesting to him, well, maybe you didn't hear, and then starts asking him, oh, I see injuries on you, on your hands. Let me see your injuries. In fact, I'm going to photograph them. But then he says, well, you know, I was standing a bit off. But while he's saying that he's standing a bit off or off to the side by the dumpsters, and again, we're talking about an alleyway behind the storefront, he's also still confirming that he never heard any statements and that he did hear the conversation that was happening, that he did approach him. He did see, he was near enough to see any injuries, although Mr. Clark apparently just got out of his sleeping bag enough to grab the food that was given to him. But that was confirmed that he never saw any injuries, never heard the statements. And indeed, he also testified that the next day he went with his friend Lewis, and that's about 22 minutes, 40 seconds into the interview. He said he saw him the next day, and Mr. Clark was giving him pointers about flying the sign. And again, he never saw any injuries, any indication that Mr. Clark had been in a fight. So although he did indicate, well, I was standing out to a distance, he never said that he was so off that he wasn't able to hear what was going on and that was directly contradicted by his initial statements that he was there, placing himself near enough to be able to hear what was being said.
So Ms. Weiss, the fact that in his own statements he was contradicting himself and the court relied on that, are you saying that the court abused its discretion to rely on that?
I'm saying that the court abused its discretion for two reasons. First of all, it was the court evidenced its misapprehension and misapplication of the law. The first thing that it did was it said that it could not consider corroborating evidence of this conversation or corroboration of the statements. For example, it said specifically, it could not consider corroboration. The defense was arguing all along that it was corroborated, the statement was corroborated by George Lycone's own statements, placing his brother there and saying that he absolutely heard what was going on, he was standing next to him, and he absolutely could corroborate exactly what George Lycone was saying. The court so misapprehended and misapplied the law in that regard, and then secondly, it mischaracterized exactly what was said. It wasn't that it was a contradictory statement. What Timothy Lycone said was that he was there, he heard exactly what was going on, and then as he was questioning further on into the interview and it became clear that the detective was not believing him, he said, well, I was standing off. But he still continued to say, if you read the transcript and you listen to the videotape, he still continued to say, but he didn't say anything about getting into a fight with his roommate. He didn't say anything about killing his roommate. So it's not necessarily contradictory, and so that's where I think that the trial court did abuse its discretion, because it was basing its ultimate holding on an erroneous view that he was out of earshot, for example. And the court made that finding in the January 6th transcript.
Hypothetically, if one portion of the interview he says that he did hear, and in another portion of the interview, hypothetically, he says, I was too far away to hear, would the trial court then abuse its discretion in not finding sufficient reliability to admit the hearsay statement?
Well, I want to first emphasize that I don't believe that that is the case here. I don't believe that Timothy Lycone went so far as to say that. However, the trial courts do look at a number of factors, and those are contained in the People v. Fuller case. I think the court has to weigh it with the defendant's right to present evidence. And in this case, the jury was misled to believe that Timothy Lycone was there, he was present, he heard these statements, and would have corroborated this. By not allowing the defense to present the evidence of Timothy Lycone's statement saying, I was there, I was with my brother, and he never said any such thing. I didn't hear anything of that nature. That deprived the defendant of his right to present a defense in this case because he wasn't able to challenge. He was left without recourse to challenge the statements made by George Lycone saying that my client said that he did this. So it was a question of fact for the jury to decide. In this case, where there were different interpretations in terms of how much Timothy Lycone had backed off of his original statements, which I think are the more reliable of them, because he had no motive to lie at that point. He had no motive to lie other than to corroborate what his brother was saying, and he indeed was contradicting what his brother was saying. So the statements themselves were reliable when he said that he was there and he didn't hear my client make any such statements. And I did want to point out, too, that if you look at Chambers v. Mississippi, it's very much on point. And in Chambers v. Mississippi, the United States Supreme Court case, the defense sought in that case to present evidence that another person had on four different occasions confessed to a murder. The defendant was thwarted by the state's evidentiary rules from presenting this evidence and was only able to partially present his defense. And there was contradictory testimony in that case as well. And the court found it was reversible error not to allow Chambers the opportunity to subject the witness to cross-examination in a challenge to the testimony through presentation of other witnesses' testimony because of the hearsay rules. And as a result, Chambers' defense was far less persuasive than it might otherwise have been. And the United States Supreme Court found that the trial court's preclusion of certain defense evidence called into question the ultimate integrity of the fact-finding process and the fact-finding function of the jury. And that's what we have here. And I think that that case really is instructive in this case because by the application of the evidentiary rules in this case, it precluded Mr. Clark from presenting a defense. And that's the ultimate error. And if I may, I'd like to touch briefly, I know I don't have much time, but I would like to touch briefly on the second issue as well. And I want to point out that, you know, a seizure of a person under the Fourth Amendment occurs when taking into account all circumstances surrounding the encounter, the police conduct would have communicated to a reasonable person that he was not at liberty to ignore the police presence and go about his business. And in Calpe, Texas, the United States Supreme Court articulated that we have never sustained against a Fourth Amendment challenge the involuntary removal of a suspect from his home to a police station and his detention there for investigative purposes, absent probable cause or judicial authorization. And that's precisely what happened in Mr. Clark's case as well. At that point, they only had statements by George Lycone, who said that my client made a statement that he had killed his roommate, and he told police this information in order to get out of being arrested in this case. The police had no knowledge that a crime had been committed at all, and yet they went to Mr. Clark's tent, the only home he knew, behind the storefront, woke him up in the middle of the night, had him put on his shoes, took him to the front of the building, handcuffed him, placed him in the back of the patrol car, and then drove around to see if the crime really did, in fact, occur.
Ms. Weiss, let me just ask you, did Mr. Clark agree to get into the police car with the police?
I think again, we look at the totality of the circumstances, and it's a reasonable person standard. And again, taking into account all the circumstances surrounding the encounter, would the police conduct have communicated to a reasonable person that they were free to go about their business? Free to go about Mr. Clark's business at the time would be to go back to sleep. He was roused from his sleep. The police were shining the flashlight, told him they needed to talk to him, brought him up front, and they said, "Do you know anybody in Edgewater?" After they had Mr. Lycone identify him, he said, "Yes, I do." They said, "Will you show us?" And he said, "Yeah." But he did not feel free to leave. Just as Kalp, when they entered into Kalp's residence, they said, "We need to talk. Let's go." And Kalp said, "Okay." That wasn't consensual. That was a Fourth Amendment seizure, just as it is in Mr. Clark's case.
But Ms. Weiss, didn't he say more than, "Okay, I'll talk to you"? Didn't he say, "I'll show you if you give me a ride"? And so he's the one who suggested that the police take him in the car so that he could show him where his friend was. He suggested it.
Well, the police asked him, "Show us where your friends are." And he said, "Okay, well, you'll have to give me a ride," because he didn't have transportation. He's a homeless individual. Under the circumstances, a reasonable person, if you were confronted or asked to leave your home, roused in the middle of the sleep by police who are armed, shining a flashlight, and then asked to escort them to the front of a storefront outside in the freezing cold, you would not feel free to disregard those requests either. That's how Mr. Clark felt. Although he indicated he couldn't drive himself, they then handcuffed him and put him in the back of a patrol car. At that point, that was an arrest, or at least a seizure that was not justified under the circumstances for investigatory purposes. And I do see that I only have 1 minute left, and I'd like to reserve the rest of my time if I may.
All right, thank you. You have 1 minute and 5 seconds left.
May it please the court. My name is Rebecca Williams, attorney registration number 43172. I sort of want to go in reverse here and start with the defendant's Fourth Amendment claim, if that's acceptable. First of all, I need to argue that the defendant failed to make this argument before the trial court, and as such is waived and not reviewable by this court. The Fourth Amendment claim. He makes two separate suppression claims, the Fifth Amendment and the Fourth Amendment claim. The Fourth Amendment was absolutely not raised and ruled upon by the trial court.
So is your argument that it's a waiver or that it just wasn't preserved, or what is your...
It wasn't preserved, and so it was waived. It's not reviewable by this trial court. There wasn't a record developed on this. I think the prosecution didn't have the opportunity to present evidence. The trial court made a finding as part of its findings on the Miranda issue, which was actually waived and argued, and there was evidence and testimony presented on it. The trial court made a finding of probable cause, but it was in the context of discussing whether at what point the defendant should have been advised of his Miranda rights. It wasn't in the context of whether probable cause existed. The prosecution didn't have the opportunity to present evidence of probable cause or even reasonable suspicion for the investigatory stop. It's just not an issue that was argued by the parties or presented to the trial court. In arguing preservation in the reply brief, the defendant points to page 130 of the suppression hearing, where he argues Cotton v. Texas. This argument, however, was only related to whether or not the police should have read the defendant his Miranda rights when he was handcuffed and placed in the police car. At no point did the defendant argue that the officer lacked reasonable suspicion or probable cause to conduct the investigation. A discussion of probable cause, as I stated, did occur between the court and the prosecution, but it was really only related to the Miranda waiver. It was only at the very end of the suppression hearing, after all of the evidence had been presented and all of the questions had been asked of the officers, and it was without any argument or input from the defense. It's not, even in the opening brief, the defendant noted that in COP, the court found it significant that he was not told that he was free to decline to go with the officers. This only further illustrates the importance of raising this claim before the trial court. Here, we don't know whether the officers told the defendant he was free to leave. These kinds of questions weren't asked because the issue wasn't before the prosecution and the prosecution wasn't defending against it. I'm happy to address the merits of this claim. Namely, I just want to, if the court did determine that it was reviewable, I wanted to articulate the defendant. The record discloses and the court's testimony and the police officer's testimony that the defendant did ask for a ride. And that's the number one reason that it's distinguishable from COP, if the court is addressing the Fourth Amendment claim. And the other reason is that the defendant, it's completely different than being roused from your home. This is the place where you sleep, but and being taken, just we need to talk, and put into a police car and taken to the station. Here, the defendant asked for a ride, basically to do a welfare check on one of his friends. The police wanted to do that. He couldn't provide them with the address of the home. They wanted to go do a welfare check on the friends and asked for the police for a ride. As I stated in my answer brief, it's somewhere in between a circumstance where a defendant asks the cop for a ride home and they need to be handcuffed for officer safety reasons and put into the back of the car, and COP, where it was essentially an arrest. He was being taken to the police to the police station because he was a suspect in a murder investigation and wasn't given an opportunity or chance to have any freedom to make a different determination or a different decision.
So you're saying that his tent where he slept is constitutionally different than a house where someone sleeps?
I'm not making that argument. That's not the way that I'm trying to distinguish COP. I'm distinguishing it in that he asked for a ride. It was part of sort of a welfare check on his friend. He asked for a ride. He agreed to show them where his friend lives. That's completely distinguishable from COP. Any COP, he was taken directly to the police station for an investigation. Here, he was given a ride to his friend's house to perform a welfare check. I think it's completely different. It's a completely different scenario. But no, I'm not drawing a distinction based on even though it may be a public place, even though it's where the defendant resides. I'm not trying to make that argument. I don't think it's necessary here, and I don't think that, as I stated, I don't think that the court even gets to that because it wasn't raised, and there just aren't significant or aren't findings on the record for this court to sort of make the determination of whether or not there was probable cause.
Well, if we do go to the merits of it, you're saying it's distinguishable because this was not an investigation. It was a mere just a welfare check on someone?
I'm not saying entirely that it wasn't an investigation. I guess I would agree with the trial court's findings about when the thing sort of became an investigatory stop versus a consensual encounter. Even though those findings, again, were really just based on a determination of when Miranda warnings were necessary. So I think I would make the same arguments and the same arguments. I did address this issue in my answer brief, so I would make the same arguments that I made there about when an investigation becomes an investigatory stop and what was reasonable. But just in the way that it's distinguishable from COP, I think that it definitely is. If the board has any further questions on that issue, we just had a defendant's first issue about residual hearsay and Timothy Lincoln's interview. The trial court appropriately excluded Timothy Lincoln's recorded interview. As the court found, the defendant failed to establish the five prerequisites to admissibility, namely that the statement had circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness. As the court found, Timothy's initial statements were that the defendant did not state that he murdered his roommate and he didn't have bruisings on his hands. But he did later clarify, and the court has this record, and I don't have a transcript here with me, but the court has the transcript and can review it. He later clarified that he wasn't close enough to hear and that he wasn't paying attention. The court found that Timothy didn't have the basis of knowledge necessary to make the statements admissible. And Timothy further was on guard throughout the interview, as is evident from the transcript and the video, and he was concerned about the reasons he was being interviewed as part of a murder investigation. Therefore, he was likely to deny any knowledge. He had a motive to sort of deny any knowledge about what occurred there and just basically not wanting to be a part of it.
So you're saying that he did deny that he had the means for hearing what was said?
I am. That's my recollection of the transcript. I mean, and it's consistent with the trial court's findings. I think that the trial court's findings here were at a minimum supported by the record. I think to argue that, he was pressured or, something like that in the defendant's argument and that he was pressured to change his story. I think that the trial court had the videotape, the trial court reviewed the testimony, and the trial court's findings about that were supported by the record. Timothy's statements in his interview were internally inconsistent. He didn't have the basis of knowledge for basically giving either of the opinions present. He had other memory and other issues, which the prosecution, if Timothy had been present to testify, would have been able to cross-examine on and draw out for the interest of justice, in a sense, also wouldn't have been served by allowing this information, knowing sort of the surrounding circumstances. But also, I think the bigger issue here with this statement is that it was harmless. And I know defense counsel and I disagree about the standard of error, the standard of reversal here, harmless versus harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, or constitutional harmless error. But under either standard, the statement or the failure to admit the statement, if there was any error, was harmless because for the same reasons that it wasn't admissible, the statement indicates that Timothy didn't have a basis of knowledge. And therefore, he couldn't have given the jury a significantly different impression or really impeached George's testimony that the defendant made a statement, because the statement by itself was that he didn't have much knowledge about it. Further, and probably most importantly, the jury by its verdict discredited George's testimony. Therefore, the potential impeachment value of Timothy's statement was really unnecessary. The statement to George and George's testimony was that the defendant confessed to having murdered his roommate, or the victim here, on Christmas Eve, and the jury discredited that. The jury acquitted him of murder, they acquitted him of all of the homicide charges, they acquitted him of first-degree assault, and they only convicted of second-degree assault, which the defendant admitted as part of his theory of the case was second-degree assault. And we also have other more reliable admissions of assault to the defendant. We have his recorded interview, and we also have his statements to police that he got into a fight. He left him on his back on Christmas Eve.
Ms. Williams, can I question you about your statement that the defendant admitted as part of his theory of the case that he committed second-degree assault? I was confused by that. Did he, or did his counsel concede that on the same night of the murder or the homicide that defendant committed second-degree assault, or that happened like weeks earlier?
The theory of the case was that he had gotten into a fight with the defendant or with the victim, but that it was weeks earlier.
So it's a different time altogether. So he didn't concede that he committed second-degree assault on the day it was charged.
Right. He had other admissions to that assault, though, in his statements to police upon his arrest in the police car, the initial interrogation. He stated that it was 3 days earlier. Right. That wasn't the theory of defense.
So contrary to what you said, they didn't agree that on the night of the charge he committed second-degree assault.
Not on the night of the charge, no. But overall, there was overwhelming evidence of the defendant's guilt here. The statement to George, the jury discredited, obviously understanding that George's testimony was that the defendant admitted to murder on the night of the incident. But the defendant also made admissions to police officers more credible and that, not impeachable by Timothy's statements that he had assaulted the defendant on the night in question. So I think that makes any error in the failure to admit Timothy's recorded interview harmless.
So just to clarify, you're saying there was other evidence of admission by Mr. Clark that he committed the assault on Christmas Eve?
Correct, yes. If the court has no further questions, I ask that you affirm the defendant's convictions. Thank you.
I would like to just address a few things here. First, the defense did raise Culpeper, Texas below. It was raised in their motion on page 60 of the pleading volume. It was raised in the 10-29-10 motions hearing, pages 130, 143 through 144. The court addressed it. I do want to indicate that there was no welfare check involved here when they contacted Mr. Clark behind the storefront. He did not know what this was about. There was no knowledge that anybody, any crime had been committed. There was no discussion of his friend or a welfare check needing to be conducted at that point. George Lightcone's testimony at trial indicated that Timothy was there. He repeatedly said, my brother was there, he heard this, he could verify. The jury was left with that impression. Without the possibility of contesting that evidence and presenting evidence that they had his brother's statements, and his brother said exactly the opposite, and he would not corroborate that, the jury was left with an erroneous impression. We'd ask the court to reverse his conviction.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and we will be issuing an opinion in due course.